This podcast is a proud member of the That Moment In podcast network. Check out the network at thatmomentin.com.
Hey, you're not going to bed yet, are you? That's right. It's time for TV Good, Sleep Bad.
So I'm staying in my own chair. Go on without me if you must.
Here are your hosts, Daniel Lackey and Elwood Jones.
Hello and welcome to another exciting edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. I'm your host as always, Elwood Jones, and joining me of course is my co-host, Mr. Daniel Lackey.
I'm the third Warner brother.
On tonight's show we are going to be looking at Animaniacs as well as learning which show Lackey's again got me addicted to as we take a look at Inside Number 9. But before we obviously get into that, it's of course time to ask that ever so prevalent question of what you've been watching. And I mean, Lackey, what's been sort of holding your interest since the last episode?
Not actually. I don't really think I've been watching anything much lately. It's been kind of a slow period here. I did make a stab at the second season of The Sinner.
Okay.
I need to get back to that, and I'm almost three episodes behind on Better Call Saul, which just about a month ago started up again. And I think tomorrow is going to be the fourth episode, and I've only seen the first episode, so I gotta do those. But really, nothing much except I did manage to get hooked on this Canadian show. I might have mentioned it last episode. A Canadian show, very fluffy type show called Private Eyes.
Oh, yes, you mentioned that.
Yeah, which stars, one of the 90210.
Jason.
I think Priestley. Yeah, I think Jason, yeah. Priestley is a hockey player who, a retired hockey player who, gets he starts a second career as a private detective in a sort of will they, won't they relationship with, a woman named Angie Everett, played by Cindy Samson. It's a fun show. It's not exactly the sort of thing that I think anybody can sit around and talk endlessly about, but it's pretty fluffy, but it's enjoyable enough. Yeah. But there's just basically kind of stuff that I've just been kind of tired and busy lately and haven't really had a whole lot of chance to keep up on things. What about you?
I mean, like yourself, it's been a really quiet sort of month. I mean, it hasn't been really helped. The scheduling gods have decided that nobody apparently is going to be watching TV this month, so there's been nothing on. It's just been a lot of repeats. So finding something worth watching has been a bit of a push. So I think I've been watching more sort of films than I've been watching TV. And it's been that sort of case where whenever you try to watch anything new, it's that this new sort of pitfall we're falling into. All the cast are like these exceptional, beautiful GQ models. It's kind of like early 2000 horror. Everyone's too pretty for me, yeah, to get involved in. And like you watch all the, like the new superhero shows, and they're all these beautiful people standing in beautiful locations and doing beautiful posing. And it's just like, I just can't connect with this. I don't know, I'm just becoming like the grouchy old man, or the fact that I'm having to work for the last season of Buffy at the moment over in Channel Superhero, and that's having a knock-on effect on everything else I'm watching at the minute.
That's the one that Whedon didn't oversee, right? That final season?
He didn't even oversee the last two seasons. Now, The season, so I'm working this out now. So season 6 is the one with Dark Willow, and this was his first season he didn't oversee. And yeah, there's a lot of hit and miss in there. I mean, everyone gets very excited about Once More With Feeling and that sort of nonsense. And the problem with season 6 is that it didn't have a big evil, so to speak. We had the trio, who were basically three guys who had previously been in the show that were thrown together because they've decided to become supervillains. And while they're entertaining enough, and certainly we see Warren, who is the guy who originally created the Buffy bot, him be going into like megalomania sort of evil as he becomes all consumed with like defeating Buffy and getting power. His journey into darkness is very interesting, but the fact that the big evil of the season is Dark Willow, it's just really, it's like, oh, really? You've managed to make Allison Hannigan more irritating than you did before.
Oh, God, yes.
And, in one hand, it could have worked. I mean, it's sort of like, oh, Buffy going up against her best friend. I mean, that's in itself is a very interesting concept. But at this point, Willow has drifted so far off being the adorable psychic that she was in the first three seasons. And really from season 4 onwards, she's just like grating as sin. I think back when it was originally on, we were all kind of distracted with the whole lesbian witch angle because, you know, there wasn't a lot of gay people on TV. The new queer movement was still really sort of finding its foothold, and, you know, we weren't all familiar, whereas now everyone was very accepting. You know, you can be bi, straight, gay, you know, be involved with man, woman, tree, plant, rock, whatever you happen to take your fancy really with, and it, nobody really bats an eyelid. But back then, obviously, you know, it was kind of shocking, really interesting at the same time. You know, teenage lesbian witches, you know, we're all down with that. But at this point, she was sort of like so irritating as a character. She was no longer the shy retiring thing. She was pretty much on the Buffy level of confidence, and her general cockiness when it came to using magic, even though Giles does tear a strip out of her. And his whole disappearance in the season also, it helps him in the terms of Buffy evolving as a character, having to stand on her own, and means he has the most wonderful comeback at the end, because Anne Stewart Head at this point had said, yo, I'm done with Buffy. All the publicity was like he was done. He had left the show and he was good. And to have him surprise come back is like right up there in the top 5 Buffy moments of all time. The last season, we've obviously got Buffy versus the first. It's just a mess, and I'm really not looking forward to working my way through it, to be honest. But, you know, when it's over, it will be a scene similar to, like, those VE Day victory photos of, you know, the sailor kissing the nurse and stuff. It's like, be on the street, like, it's over! And then knowing me, I'll probably find some other stupid project to get attached to for another 4 years, but so be the world. Yeah, so that's my sort of gripe with on TV. I've been going off on like a real Cronenberg sort of binge recently to sort of counter it. But the few shows I have watched, I binged the first 2 seasons of Fresh Off the Boat. Okay. Which is an all Asian comedy. It's an American produced show based on Eddie Wong's book of the same name. And it's basically about him and his family adjusting to life in America in Orlando. It's a really fun show. It's all the cast and that are really fantastic. And I think it's one I'm going to discuss more on a later show, because it's really the first all Asian show we've had since Margaret Cho's All-American Girl, which is another show I would really like to discuss at a later episode, because there's an absolute blinding episode that I just really want to share, and I keep watching over and over again, because like Fresh Off the Boat, All-American Girl is really, really good, and one of the newer sitcoms that's actually worth checking out. So really annoyingly, they decided to stop showing it over here, so I'm trying to track down some tape so I can see like season 3 onwards, so we'll probably come back to that. But the main sort of things that have held my sort of interest here, Mark Kermode, one of my big film mentors, has done a 6-part film fairy series called Mark Kermode's Secrets of Cinema. Each episode focuses on a different genre. So you've got heist movies, romantic comedies, horror, sci-fi, and coming-of-age movies. And again, this is a really great series, especially for anyone like myself and like Film Fury, as he breaks down the structure of these different genres, the key elements that go into making them what they are. And the added bonus, of course, being that it's co-written with my other main mentor, Kim Newman.
Kim Newman, I was going to say.
So it's all like the two almighty powers in my critiquing mental world have just come together and created this wonderful series for 6 episodes.
And actually, Kim Newman's mustache probably constitutes its own mentor in a way.
Kim Newman and his wonderful style. I mean, Kim Newman was steampunk before steampunk was a thing.
Yeah.
And I love the fact people think it's a costume, but it's not. This is just how Kim dresses.
Yeah, no, I remember the Doctor Who DVDs. They would release them, and they would all, you know, each story would have this, you know, just be chock full of all these extras, and they come and they'd take all these sort of randos from various walks of life and interview them about things. I remember there's one just a Doctor Who story from the Tom Baker era where they're interviewing Kim Newman about Cybermen or something like that.
Oh yeah,
it's hilarious.
He's just fantastic. I mean, anything British sci-fi, he's there. Horror especially. I mean, as I've already mentioned before, he wrote The Essential Volume. If you're a horror fan, you need to own a copy of Nightmare Movies. He's just done a second book of his reviews, his video dungeon reviews, which I've yet to work through because, I mean, it's another 1,000 pages here. I mean, the guy churns out material like nobody's business. He works at such a rate.
If I recall correctly, he's also a fiction writer as well. He does the Anno Dracula series.
And he did his own Choose Your Own Adventure book called Life's Lottery.
Awesome.
Where the starting point is you choosing which of the Men from U.N.C.L.E. is your favorite. And it's like, are you a Napoleon Solo man? And
that is somehow is probably the most Kim Newman thing I could possibly imagine.
Yeah, I mean, I sucked when I played it. I kept like dying, like, I don't know, just getting started. Because you start off as a kid, and your choices as a kid then affect how your adult life turns out. And I mean, the whole journey is affected just by you choosing which of the two leads from Man from U.N.C.L.E. you prefer. So, but yeah, it's very, if you can get hold of it, it's really worth giving a look. I mean, if you've got a library, you should be able to get it through there, because it's not one of those ones that's easy to get hold of in print, but I'm sure there's probably like ebook or something version going around, so definitely check that one out. Yes. Obviously. It's okay, it's alright, we don't need to rattle, it's not like we're recording in here or anything, so. Thank you, honey. Love you. So, the sound of the rubbish being taken out there sounds wonderful in the podcast, so. The other sort of interesting thing for myself is obviously the return of King of the Road on Viceland. This is Thrasher's scavenger hunt / skate tournament, which for myself, I mean, it's taken longer to warm up to the teams this year. We just had the mystery guests be introduced, which has seen the return of Jaws, who's looking for his 5th win on King of the Road, and Jamie Foy, who is one of my favorites because, you know, like myself, he's a big guy who skates, and unlike myself, he skates well. So I'm really excited to see him return, especially because he got signed to Death Wish on last year's tournament. So seeing him back at it is really good. But the last episode they showed had Jaws suffering like one of the most horrific skating injuries I've ever seen.
Wow.
He basically broke his teeth doing a jump. But it's, I mean, If you're a friend of anything squeamish, don't watch that particular thing, because basically his bottom teeth get bent inwards, which is really not too pleasant. But they had the best joke, I think it's Foundation, who had the best prank on their team. They convinced the oldest skater on the team that they've got to do geriatric day, so the skater has to walk with a cane, wear adult diapers, and have all his food blended. At the same point, they had him bomb down a hill, so he basically came all the way down this hill and then hit concrete and skidded across in his backside so fast he's like skidded across, and it's sort of like seeing a man in adult diapers skid across concrete. It's never pleasant, but it was kind of amusing at the same time. So,
yep, wow.
But yeah, as always with King of the Road, it's sort of like one of those things that I kind of would like to have covered back when I was, you know, young and hungry as a freelancer, rather than, you know, more mature and enjoy sleeping in a bed, state of mind. And it's sort of like when you're young and dumb, then you're quite happy to sleep on cargo planes and in the dirt and whatnot. So, but now I sort of like, I'm quite happy just to watch this thing unfold. But yeah, it's another great blend of prankery and skating. So, but yeah, like I said, it's just a very light month for myself. It's, I think, there's just not been a huge amount to really catch sort of interest. I mean, there's other bits and pieces that are like flashing up. Like, we got 5 days, which is starting soon. Was it Afraid of the Walking Dead or Beware the Walking Dead?
Fear the Walking Dead.
Which is, it's just started a terrestrial run here. So I might actually watch it, even though it's been on Amazon for a while, and obviously Netflix are busy churning out their shows, but I'm behind, much like, so when you say, like, have you seen Better Call Saul? I'm not even started that one yet, so.
Yeah.
But you keep telling me it's good, so.
The first episode was good.
Okay.
That's as far as I got in the new season.
I was about to say, you were just saying the first episode, like, the whole show is good, and it's sort of like, why are you still watching it?
You haven't even seen any of Better Call Saul yet?
No, I mean, I keep, like, saying, you know, I'm going to sit down and watch Better Call Saul, and then I see, like, oh, Michelle Wolf's got a new episode on, and,
they canceled her, though, unfortunately.
Really?
Yep.
Okay, that's a shame.
I was disappointed in that, too.
Her show, stand-up slash show, it's hard to describe what her show is, but that's a shame that they axed that. So it means I've now basically subscribed to Netflix for Love and Glow at the minute, then?
Yeah. They canceled her show, and I think they canceled Joel McHale's show. I don't know what the situation is over in Britain, but I can say here the market is probably a little bit oversaturated with the sort of satirical, politically driven comedy commentary shows. You know, we have, considering that both of them, both Late Night and The Tonight Show have gone in that direction. And then on top of that, you've got The Daily Show, you've got Full Frontal with Sam B, you've got John Oliver's Last Week Tonight, or whatever that show is called. I think the market over here, I don't know, I'm sure some of these make their way over to you, if not all of them. But I think there's maybe, and I don't even know if you have any of those things, like any homegrown like versions of those shows. If you have anybody over there who goes and picks apart whatever Theresa May is doing this week.
I mean, we have a few shows like that. I mean, we got The Last Leg, which is kind of like our main satirical one. That's on break at the moment. But we obviously get The Week That Was, the John Oliver one. I can't watch The Daily Show since Jon Stewart left, because I don't like the host, the way his
you don't like Trevor Noah?
His accent. I mean, the bits I see, he's very good at interviewing, and he's a good follow-up to John Oliver, but his accent is just, is it British, is it American? It's kind of like Colin Salmon. I just
South African.
Is that what you see? I'm just
yeah. Like, he's South African.
It's like Colin Salmon in
yeah.
It's sort of like I just can't stand his accent. So I'm like overjoyed when I'm watching like a Paul Doria Sands movie and he dies. It's like yay.
Yeah.
Bonus points for you.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean,
no, it's South African.
Okay, he's got a stand-up special that's just come out on Comedy Central, which, again, I never watched because it's just the accent, it's just too distracting. But again, I suppose a lot of people say that about Michelle Wolf.
Michelle Wolf's voice, it took me a little while to get used to. But pretty much probably everybody else on the planet, I first really noticed her when she did the correspondence dinner, yeah. Thing earlier on this year. And it was like, you know, her voice irritated me for about a minute. And then it was like, no, this is really cutting and brilliant. And it's high time somebody did this to them. You know, it's high time they start tweaking these assholes where they live.
Oh yeah. And I think, with her voice, I mean, it's part of her shtick. It's kind of like Joan right. Collins and her vagina. It's sort of like yeah. It's sort of like now worked in. It's sort of like how
it's as much part of her shtick as you know, Bob Tech Goldthwait or Guilford Godfrey. Yeah,
exactly. And you kind of like you can't get irritated because it's part of the, as you say, it's part of the shtick. So, and when she had that first episode and she has I can't remember the comedian's name, and it's basically the whole joke is basically, we've got two female comedians here with the most annoying voices ever. Let's see how long we can drag this out for. as I said, she's just like a completely fearless comic. And
yeah,
I'm really looking forward to when she gets her stand-up special. Because, I mean, this is the thing with Netflix. I mean, now everyone gets a stand-up special. It's sort of like, if we haven't got a project for you, you get a stand-up special. And
even if we do have a project for you, you get a stand-up
special. Yeah, because these things are cheap to make. So it's just like we find you a stage to stand on, we just shoot you with free cameras, and there you go. Although I really would love to see another John Waters special. After This Filthy World, I'd just waiting for the follow-up. I mean, if Kevin Smith can have, like, 6 DVDs of him doing spoken words sort of / Q&A. I think we can have another John Waters. I mean, speaking of Bob Goldthwait, you just reminded me, I did actually watch the Robin Williams documentary Come Inside My Mind, which I was very disappointed with.
I have heard mixed reviews of that.
I think my main criticism is the fact that the main comedian that they talked to is Billy Crystal. Which is all fine and good, but the only footage they have of Bobcat Goldthwait, his best friend, is promotional footage for, I think it's Man of the Year, World's Greatest
Father
of the Year. And it's a shame, really, because, I mean, every time I've listened to, like, Bobcat Goldthwait being on, like, Marin or Gilbert Godfrey, he always has, like, the most interesting, like, insights into his friendship with Robin Williams and, like, the fact that he said, I knew I was good friends with him because I spent time bored with him. And like when he talks about going around William's house and just like watching him playing Call of Duty and just like casting out kids. So there's like some kid somewhere in the world who's been like cast out by the genie from Aladdin. So,
yeah.
I don't know. I mean, it's very informative, but at the same time, it just felt like went a little longer than I wanted. And I don't know. It just didn't give me... It felt like it was missing something. Missing the right people or something. I couldn't quite put my finger on it. But obviously, speaking of career retrospective documentaries, I mean, the sort of benchmark from at the moment is the Andre the Giant documentary that came out through HBO. Even if you're not like a wrestling fan and just know who Andre the Giant is, it's an absolutely fascinating and really emotionally heartbreaking documentary to watch. Profiles his complete career from growing up as a child through to his sort of like final days. And it's just an absolute insight into just this phenomenal character who was like larger than wrestling and larger than life. And just hearing like Arnold Schwarzenegger talk about going to dinner with Andre and arguing over who would pay the bill. And then Andre the Giant basically picks him up and puts him on a shelf and is like, no, I pay.
Yeah.
It's just the idea of Arnold Schwarzenegger being like picked up is just like, that's the footage I want to see. So, but yeah, I mean, is there anything else you want to talk about though?
Not particularly.
Okay. One to obviously the first of our selections tonight. We're going to be looking at Animaniacs, in particular episodes 2 and 3. This was obviously my pick as for some reason I just felt really compelled to revisit Animaniacs recently, and I thought, what better way to do it than on a podcast that talks about cool films and, well, cool TV even. I can subject Lucky to at the same time, because I'm right in saying that this was kind of like a Buffy situation. You were aware of the show and the working pieces, but you never actually watched it.
I believe, actually, no, I shouldn't say I believe, because they actually have the date of 1993 at several points in the episode, the second or third episode. This was something that was slightly after my time, kind of in that sort of weird zone where cartoons were, at this point, most animated series. There had been kind of inklings, and this is stuff, you know, whenever you and I talk about animated shows, I almost, of this vintage, I almost always invariably mention that there's this sort of weird zone, this weird time at the beginning of the 90s where there is the idea of there's animated shows that are pitched to kids and animated shows that are pitched towards an older audience, and this is about the time, apart from like The Simpsons, which did kind of get that crossover demographic. But this is kind of the era where they start basically starting to pitch these cartoons at both an older and a younger audience. Yeah, you know, the old Rocky and Bullwinkle, you know, split level where you're making these, you're doing these very simple gags which please the kids, and then there's all these other gags that go over the kids' heads but the parents recognize. And this kind of had a resurgence in the early 90s with Ren and Stimpy, which had started off over here on as a Nickelodeon show and then got transferred over to MTV when it was basically found out, when basically they realized that it basically had a huge audience of basically like stoners in their late teens. And then the show, which is basically, and there's even a reference, I don't recall which of the two episodes we watched it's in, but there's even a reference to it in one of the episodes of Animaniacs, the predecessor to Animaniacs, which was the Tiny Toons.
Oh yeah.
Which was also a joint, Warner Brothers, Amblin, Steven Spielberg production. And I was kind of a fan of Tiny Toons, but in, you know, 1993, that was the year I turned 20. So that kind of, the first I had started to hear of Animaniacs was maybe about a year or two after it had started. And my friends, I had a number of friends at the time who were significantly older than I was. They had just started to have families, and they were talking about their kids watching Animaniacs and how clever they thought it was. So it kind of fell through that kind of crack. It would have been, if it had debuted in like 98 or 99, I probably would have watched it because, you know, like I said, by the late 90s, you had, you know, Cartoon Network was, by that point, it was unashamedly pitching its shows, not just to the kids, but also to the adults. And, you know, by 98 or 99, I had completely become hooked on Powerpuff Girls, which is a show I want to do sometime.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, Animaniacs was something I was aware of. I basically kind of knew a lot of it, but like I said, It debuted the year I turned 20, so it was not. This was the first time I'd actually sat down and watched a full episode. You know, I'm familiar with a lot of kind of the tropes of the thing. I'm familiar with the style of the humor because it is really the same kind of humor they used on Tiny Toons. Mm-hmm. Obviously, Pinky and the Brain, I know who they are. They being the breakout stars of the show. They're probably more recognizable, really, than even the Warner Brothers and sister. So I know the tropes, but I don't really know the show.
Yeah, I mean, Animaniacs, I mean, this comes out of the anime revival, really, which is around the early 90s, because obviously you had Disney, and Don Bluth goes off and does his own thing. And I mean, for my personal stuff, there's three main styles of American animation. You've got Disney, you got Don Bluth, who is like more snarling villains and cigar chomping villains, and everything's like a lot more sort of like adult edge to it. And then we had what's his bloody name, Ralph, and then you obviously had Ralph Bakshi. And Ralph Bakshi's sort of like the guy who sort of paves the way for adult animation. He was doing things like Fritz the Cat and Coonskin and Heavy Traffic and Cool World.
Right.
And between these like three main animated film bodies, it sort of slowly filters into what the cartoon studios were doing. So we see around this period, Hanna-Barbera enter their dark period, and they're doing things like SWAT Cats, another show that we're going to talk about on another episode, because it's awesome. And in particular, Warner Brothers, they, as you said, they did Tiny Toons, and then they come along and they do Animaniacs. Now, Animaniacs is slightly different, obviously, than Tiny Toons, because Tiny Toons was basically like supposed to be like the younger versions of their established Warner Brothers characters, but
yeah, it was Warner Brothers. It was the Looney Tunes babies.
Yeah,
it was to Warner Brothers what Muppet Babies was to the Muppets.
And then they decided, no, wait a minute, we want to use the Warner Brothers characters like Bugs and Daffy and that, so we'll have them be like nieces and nephews and cousins. So they started doing these really strange sort of family units. And then obviously with Animaniacs, these are completely unique characters. The basic premise being that you've got the two Warner Brothers, Yakko and Wakko, and their little sister Dot, who are created, but they're deemed too insane. So they're locked up in the Warner Brothers water tower, and the whole premise of the show is that they basically keep escaping and going off adventures, and they make up the main meat of this variety show, which includes songs and other equally bizarre characters. In the episodes we're looking at, we get to see Pinky and the Brain, and we get to see my personal favourite, Slappy Squirrel, who isn't voiced by Jodie Foster, as I thought for years she was. I think it's just the mannerisms. It's for some reason I always think of Jodie Foster when I see Slappy Squirrel, but she's actually Sherry Stoner who does that, along with Nathan Ruger, who plays her special nephew Skippy.
Yeah.
The thing with Animaniacs is that, unlike a lot of cartoons, as you said already, I mean, this is one of, even before The Simpsons were doing it, it was operating that multi-level humor. So you would have jokes for, like, the kids, lots of slapstick, and that sort of humor. And then you would have, like, these very subtle jokes that were thrown in for the adults. And in particular, there's a joke about where squirrels hide their nuts in the Skippy Squirrel skit. I mean, you just type in, like, 10 most shocking jokes for Animaniacs, and you can see what they slip past the censor. A lot of it's about show me the bird or give me the finger. And
yeah.
But, it's a very unique show, and I think it's one that when you come back to it as an adult and that you realize just how sharp some of the writing is in this, because a lot of it, when you're watching as a kid, just goes over your head.
Right.
And certainly these characters are really a lot more random. They push the boundaries a lot further than any of their sort of contemporaries at the time. It's very sort of out there, the humor, and it's sort of verging on that Ren and Stimpy sort of territory, whereas when Ren and Stimpy, like Ralph Bakshi, they're just completely out there. They don't care. This is like and Beavis Butthead, they're sort of like creations made for the creator's amusement and the amusement right. of their friends only. It doesn't really matter if the audience is baffled by it, as long as the creator is like getting a kick out of it. That's all that seems to matter. And
it's I call that the Adult Swim aesthetic.
Yes,
where it's you know, the 90% of the things in the glory days of Adult Swim, you would watch and you would walk away from them saying, what the hell is the target audience for this? You know, it's especially for some of, you know, the weirder. It's just, you know, you look at the bizarre, some of the stuff that, you know, caught on, and it's just, somebody finally showed me a clip from Tim and Eric a couple weeks ago, and I'm like, what's the audience for this? There are, it's not even necessarily that I thought it was unfunny, it's just that it just seemed so weird.
Yeah.
That I couldn't really imagine it finding, you know, looking back and saying to myself, looking back and says, yes, these people found an audience. And, you know, Heidecker and Eric, what's his name, are considered to be, you know, they're prominent comics. And I'm like, there's more than five people that find this kind of thing funny. And that's, you know, that's the sort of thing that, you know, that Adult Swim really was best known for, you know, stuff like, you know, Wondrous Shozen, which I could imagine only appealing to four people in the entire world, you know. But yeah, the sort of that again kind of comes out of, and Aeon Flux, which you've done in the past, I think is also kind of part of that aesthetic. It's like, yeah, we're going to do a cyberpunk dystopia adventure anime thing with no continuity.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's going to be a hit.
At the same time, I really loved all the things that came out of this era. And certainly when we look at the way things are going at the moment, everything seems to be now, if they're bringing back shows, it's in a Steven Universe style of animation, which is really annoying. Like, we've seen Thundercats coming back, but it's going to be like Steven Universe. We've got Animaniacs, which is also coming back in 2020, but before I can see, the animation's also going to be like Steven Universe. And it's sort of like, it's annoying the fact that now whenever we have a new animated show, it's always like very much in the style of whatever's popular at the moment. Right. And there are obviously a few shows which obviously break the mold. I mean, when we've got things such as like Star vs. the Forces of Evil, Phineas and Ferb, Gravity Falls, which another show I really want to cover at some point where we're talking about animation. Gravity Falls is probably one of the greatest things that Disney Channel have done in a very long time. It's kind of like Eerie Indiana, but as a cartoon.
Interesting.
So we'll talk about that a bit more later. But obviously, the episodes we looked at tonight, I mean, first off, we got to talk about the Countries of the World song, which has got to be one of the greatest pieces of musical writing ever. And the fact that Rob Paulsen, who voices Yakko, when he does appearances, can actually do the whole song completely off the top of his head and very rarely makes mistakes. And
I'm impressed.
I mean, this is a song which speeds up after every block. Yeah. And you think, oh, I can sing along to this. Like, I watch it a few times and I can get it. But when you get into like the third or fourth block and the speed he's going, and it's all in rhythm with the music, it's all like this din da din da din da din da, and it's like United States kind of thing.
Yeah.
And it basically came out of the fact that when they were writing the song, they were just looking at the world map and they realized that the countries, you know, you could rhyme them together. And that's where that one came from. And they did other little skits like that. They did one for presidents. They did one for states. And in many ways, there's often cases where you would have these little skits where they were actually funnier than the main skits. There's another popular one called Good Idea, Bad Idea, where you've got Mr. Schoolface, who's like, looks like this character who they've got bored animating halfway through. So he's got like a line drawing face. And he's sort of like, good idea, hugging your friends and family. Bad idea, hugging your enemies. And it just shows him being like throttled by some burly guy. And it's like, good idea, feeding the birds in the park. Bad idea, feeding the bears. And just him being attacked by a bear. And It's that was the thing I always liked about Animaniacs, the fact that you never really, even though you knew the sort of setup, you never knew what you were going to get, and especially with how they love to parody celebrity. And these are like 1940s celebrities. I mean, you look at the opening credit and it's like News of the World, and you've got like references there to Phantom of the Opera, The General, Public Enemy, and it's sort of like, I don't know kids who are going to get references to like silent era movies that you're throwing in here, or saying that Reagan, who they show on the like psychiatrist couch of Dr. Otto Scratch and Sniff, and is like, shows him right on the pad, has narcissistic tendencies, delusions of grandeur. And I'm thinking, well, no kid's ever going to get that joke, never mind who know who Reagan is, so.
Right.
But, yeah, I mean, obviously the Animaniacs' main sort of skits, we see them try to sell cookies to Albert Einstein in the land of chocolate, cuckoo cots, and neutrality, but mainly chocolate.
But mainly chocolate.
If there's some reason they got this real like 1950s B-movie style to every announcement that's on the show.
I thought when they had started that bit, I thought they were going to do it for all the world. I thought they were going to do something that was going to be like The Sound of Music.
Okay.
And they were going to have to battle Nazis or something like that.
Yeah. But no, it's just that they basically want to earn their Scouts badge by selling Scout cookies. And they do have that wonderful joke of where Einstein's like, what am I supposed to do with Boy Scout cookies? And they're like, well, eat them's a good thing. again, it's just like simple little things. It's the simple jokes that I like it the best. It's sort of like when he's there, like timing the speed of light, it's like, wow, that's quick.
Yeah.
But I mean, just obviously focus on the Warner brothers and Warner sister Dot. I mean, even though she's called Dot, her full name is actually Princess Angelina Contessa Luisa Francesca Banana Fana Bo Beseca the Third.
Of course.
And I don't know why Wacko has a Liverpudlian accent, so don't ask me on that one.
Yet. I was going to ask you that. Does anybody know why he seems to come from Liverpool?
Why does he sound like Ringo Starr? No, I have no idea.
Why does he sound like Ringo Starr, but only half the time?
Does he?
Maybe that voice actor gets more consistent later on in the series, but I kept hearing the accent slip.
Okay.
He'd go about three or four words, and then he would just like kind of lapse into this sort of exaggerated cartoon voice.
Okay. I mean, he's voiced by Jess Harnell, who also did Crash Bandicoot.
Okay.
Wacko's one of my favorite characters. So I don't know. I guess I just tend to overlook it. I mean, he is up, obviously, against Rob Paulsen, who's doing Yakko. And I mean, Rob Paulsen, he's just like a heavyweight of voice acting. I mean, he did like things like Raphael and Donatello in the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles cartoon. He voices like five or six different characters on the show as well. Same much like Tress MacNeille, who does a lot of the female characters.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, what did you obviously make of the sort of episodes that we looked at here?
Probably the two Warner's skits, those are probably my least favorites. Okay. I was really, and actually the song, I admired the cleverness of the country song, but I really actually preferred the song that's at the end of the second episode, which is of an ilk. I don't know what the title is, but it's kind of an ilk with the Monty Python Galaxy
song. Okay, yeah.
But I really much preferred the Pinky and the Brain and Slappy Squirrel Bits.
Yeah.
The Pinky and the Brain one, and again, it kind of shows you the aesthetic here that you've got, that you're taking this, you're pitching it at a show for kids, but you have these two characters who have, for all intents and purposes, the voices of Orson Welles and Stan Laurel, you know, and or a very dopey Stan Laurel. If there's some other thing that I'm supposed to be getting out of Pinky, I don't know. But the Pinky, once they get, I think the Pinky and the Brain short was kind of slow in getting started. But once they got to the Chip parody set, it's just, you know, the minute the Brain gets into that mechanical suit, it's just comedy gold.
Oh, definitely, because he's just basically
in a taxi. It's like, what happened to your head? Nothing happened to my head. I'm a mouse inside. I'm a mouse inside a gigantic human shaped suit. Oh, that makes sense.
The fact that he doesn't bother to make a head.
Yes. And then going on to, you know, the Jeopardy parody and almost winning the $99,000, except for the fact that, of course, the Brain doesn't know the answer to the question that Pinky has been shouting all night and loses the chance to get his win by his combobulator or whatever. You know, I thought that was, and just really just the way Maurice LaMarche intones the line, "What is a Regis Philbin?" I think really justifies that whole thing.
Yeah, I love the, I mean, again, I mean, this is Rob Paulsen puts in the voice of Pinky, when we got Maurice LaMarche as the voice of Brain. Maurice LaMarche is probably best known for playing Egon Spengler in both The Real Ghostbusters and its follow-up Extreme Ghostbusters. So his voice, once you put those two characters together, you can see a lot of similarities in the voice pattern. Yeah, like yourself, I totally agree. Once he gets into the suit, it becomes a lot funnier, but you do obviously have the plot to put everyone, nail everyone to the ground by creating a magnetic device that targets the loose change in their pocket. And the fact that Pinky points out the floor, that what happens if people just take their pants off, and he's like,
why don't people take their pants off?
It's like,
well, I'll just have to do it quickly.
But yeah, just the fact that he's this mouse head in this giant body, and nobody ever questions it. And the fact that they keep getting his name wrong and keep calling him Brian.
Brian. Brain.
I mean, on the show, it did obviously spawn its own spin-off, Pinky and the Brain, where we got a longer opening theme tune, which my wife loves to sing at me. Now, in the actual show, there was a they did come up against a genetically altered hamster who was evil and voiced by Roddy McDowall. So if you're a fan of what's that film called? Not Nightbreed.
Fright Night?
Yes, if you're a fan of Fright Night, that's something to be excited about, certainly.
And I also really enjoyed the Slappy Squirtle one. I think, again, that was another one. I think it took a while to get going, but like I said, once they get to the, once they get to the dog's yard, I just love the patent absurdity of some of these situations. Like, yeah, here's a dog. A dog's going to give you a xylophone as, you know, a token of goodwill. Of course it's rigged with a bomb, you know, but that one I particularly liked because it's like, I loved how it's like kind of like a demonstration, actually to an extent. So is the Pirate Mel one. But I felt the Pirate Mel one went on a little bit too long. But it's like a demonstration and it's a dissertation on cartoon physics.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, Slappy Squirrel, I mean, she's basically a former cartoon sort of legend who's now basically in retirement and has become bitter and old, and become old and bitter. So she basically spends all the time hanging out with her cousin. Hanging out with her nephew, Skippy. And yeah, her cartoons are very Tom and Jerry esque. So in this one, obviously she's trying to get walnuts, but she's going to steal them from the yard of Doug the dog, who she's not got the best of relationships from, as seen by the fact that when he's introduced, he's punching a Skippy Squirrel punching bag.
Yeah,
with that wonderful animation of just the punching animation is just wonderful. But yeah, I mean, she's voiced by Sherry Stoner, who has got a very sort of Bronx sort of twang to her accent. But just the fact that she's like so bitter and doesn't care about anyone at all, and somehow manages to constantly use these sort of slapsticky antics to best anyone around her. It's sort of like anyone who comes into contact with her normally comes off the worst for it. And they're probably best off just getting out of the way. But for whatever reason, Doug the dog has decided he's not going to let her steal any walnuts from the yard. There's a wonderful joke as well about e-numbers in kids' food. It's sort of like when she picks up like the cereal that Skippy's eating, and it's like bright orange. It's like, oh, there's a color found in nature. But yeah, I mean, obviously with the Skippy the Squirrel one, we obviously have the greatest joke of these two, where it's like, squirrels often hide their nuts where the sun doesn't shine. But yeah, I mean, what is there any particular sort of aspects about the Slappy Squirrel that sort of really stood out to you, or is it just sort of like the construction of it that you liked?
The construction, I like the structure of it. I liked, and one thing that impressed me overall, and also impressed me overall from my memories, for that matter, of Tiny Toons, is that this is kind of like a this is kind of like an era, the early 90s, that you start to have this, or even in the 90s in total. It's coming off of Roger Rabbit, and you're having this nostalgia for kind of like old cartoons or older cartoons. And this is really kind of like this revival of the Warner Brothers aesthetic, obviously, the Tiny Toons and Silly Symphony, Merry Melodies. And Silly Symphonies, that was Disney. But this whole thing, you know, the Carl Stalling, xylophone-driven music, the very distinct animation styles, Frizz Freleng, and there's reference to Frizz Freleng in the Slappy Squirrel bit, Chuck Jones, and there's a lot of Chuck Jones influence to her, especially in a design aspect, especially when she smiles. She has a very Chuck Jonesy smile. Just that kind of whole, it's like kind of like an updating of that, this whole sort of, you know what, that duck's crazy type thing, where it's just basically these sort of, you know, and obviously you've seen those cartoons, I'm assuming, they, where you bring in Daffy, the early Daffy Duck ones, where he's just like, you know, bouncing all over the place going, woo, 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 woo. And that's what this really is, kind of like a, you know, the idea being. And this is the sort of thing, if you're hip to what this is in the style of, and you know your Warner Brothers history, you realize that when they do like the Origins of the Animaniacs bit at the beginning, that if Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny were the ones that they actually let onto the screen, then you're almost horrified at the prospect of how insane these three have to be. They're the ones that Warner Brothers had to lock away because they were too insane. They were more insane than Daffy Duck. They were more insane than Bugs Bunny. That's how freaking insane these characters are. You know, so that's just sort of like existential dread, which started to fill me. Well, not dread, but you know what I'm getting at. This sort of anticipation, it's like, oh God, what have I gotten myself into?
Oh yeah. I think they definitely play up as well when you hit it on the head when you see like Daffy Duck, who's like a pain in the ass whenever he turns up anywhere. And the fact that whenever the Warner trio turn up anywhere, they're an absolute pain in the ass. And the fact that they push it so much further than Daffy would, and the fact that they don't have any sort of care or consideration for anyone, they're just happy just to like, they're basically like Lawrence Turney and Devil Forms a Lift. You can have the greatest day ever, and then this trio of bad assholes turn up and just like ruin your day totally.
It's almost like a Marx Brothers thing where they're just agents of chaos, and you put them into any situation and they will fuck it up.
Definitely.
You know, they will fuck it up. And when you walk, you will walk away from, you know, now you yourself are a cartoon character. That's one of the things I actually really did enjoy. That was probably my favorite gag in the Slappy Squirrel when Skippy says, but that was a cartoon and this is real life. You know, that to me was absolutely golden. It's like you have this universe where characters like Doug the Dog and Pirate Mel don't realize they're cartoons. cartoons. They don't realize they're characters on a cartoon show. And that is knowledge that Slappy and Wacko Jacqueline Dot, that's knowledge they do have. And that they are more than willing to use that against you, you know? That is the whole kind of thing. Like I said, they're basically, you put them in any situation, and by the end, you're not going to know whether you're coming or going. And I think they get that aspect of recreating the feel of an old Looney Tune. They get that absolutely right.
Yeah.
You know, it's certainly updated for modern sensibilities. It's in the style of the old animators, but it's not entirely, you don't see it. It's an homage, but it's got its own kind of visual aesthetic. There are the obvious references, more timely references, not just. The one thing I found particularly nostalgic in the title sequence was Bill Clinton playing the saxophone, which is something that, was all over the place in 1993, but I don't really know how many people remember that today. I don't even, know how well that gag would go, goes over, outside the U.S., that series of things that he did right after becoming president, where you play the saxophone, go out and play the saxophone. He was on, I think, Arsenio Hall's show. But yeah, it's got this sort of, they're very much, I felt that the writers and the animators and the voice actors did this very good job of not replicating that aesthetic or the doing it as an homage that was still its own original thing and felt of the 90s instead of something that they were just doing of the 40s, of the 50s. I felt they got that. I felt they hit that on the head.
Yeah, I mean the thing that I love about Animaniacs is the fact that they were never afraid to sort of mix things up. So there's an episode called Animaniacs Jew where they mix up all the characters. So you've got Pinky and another character called Rita, who's a cat, so it's Pinky and the cat. They had the Warner Brothers, who replaced Dot with Slappy Squirrel, and they go to visit So Darn Insane. There's another one as well where they do a parody of Cisco and Ebert, who they get Slappy gets revenge for blasting her cartoons, but in this they're called Hisco and Egbert, and that includes a lot of clips from like Looney Tunes shorts like What's Opera Doc, Duck and Mock, and Porky and Wacky Land. It's you never really knew what you were going to get with it. And as I said, they're parodying Siskel and Ebert by having like Codger Egbert and Lean Hiskel. You have to wonder, so like, what are they make? Is this Spielberg sort of element mean that they have got more sort of freedom to go with more adult content, like create this show where it's hitting a wider audience than if it was just like a traditional Warner Brothers cartoon?
But you see, I don't remember. Again, I'm slightly older than a lot of people that I know. So a lot of people like that I know, a lot of people that are my age now. And you're like 35 or 36, 35, right? Yeah. 35. So you're like, I'm 44. So you're a significant chunk of change younger than I am. But like a lot of my friends, like I'm 44. So a lot of my friends were in their earlier 40s. Like just that gap of 1 or 2 years means that they will make references to like DuckTales or the Ghostbusters cartoons that I don't get, because those things were just slightly after my time.
Yeah.
They were slightly as I was kind of trying to assert myself as a young adult and wasn't going to watch any of these things, which were, geared towards, littler kids, damn it. I'm the guy who always likes to point out that I'm old enough to remember not necessarily Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles as an adult comic book, but as something that if you were a kid, you weren't supposed to be reading Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So I always had this sort of look of a weird amusement on my face when, you know, the cartoon version of the Turtles gets mentioned. There was a point to what I was saying. I don't remember what it is. I have completely derailed my own conversation and train of thought.
Okay.
But yeah, things. It's good.
I'm glad that you enjoyed it.
Yeah.
Because of the tone of it, it's very difficult to know what way people are going to take it. And I was like, as I said, I was watching like, especially the anime, our main trio, their segments, they can be a little overwhelming at times, and I think that's the main sort of detriment to the show. And it's ironic, seeing as they're the title people, but when they're used right or when they hit the notes, they really can just like really sort of make some real magic happen. But if anything, and I mean, I'm just happy.
These are episodes 2 and 3 of the entire series.
Yes,
I'm assuming that later on in the run, and again, these are cartoons, so this probably didn't run for years and years and years.
It ran for 2 years.
Probably only ran it for how many years?
It ran for 2 years, and I mean, they got a film out of it as well. Let's just say, just counting up the episodes here. So they made around 99 episodes.
Because the afternoon cartoon episode orders tended to be much larger and the seasons longer, and therefore the shows didn't run as long.
Yeah.
You know, because you were running, you know, I don't know how these things ran in Britain, but this was stuff that was on every day when you got home from school. You know, that was the slot it ran in. It ran at like 3 or 4 p.m. weekdays. You know, so I'm assuming that later on in the run, they kind of tighten this stuff up and things get, you know, while I'm sure a lot of these things are being filmed, you know, and produced and present, they're not being presented to the audience in the order that they were produced. I'm assuming they kind of tighten the ship up much, you know, later on in the season.
Oh, definitely.
And things, they start to land, you know, things start to hit a lot more than they miss, because that's invariably how any TV show goes.
Yeah, I mean, even if you compare like episode 1 to episode 2 and 3, which we obviously looked at, there's such a jump in quality. I mean, the first episode is really sort of introducing the Warner Brothers and Dot. And a lot of it's spent with the psychiatrist, Dr. Scratch and Sniff. And it, for myself, it really sort of drags along. And there's a musical number based on the Harry Belafonte song, Monkey, called the Monkey Song, which it has some good beats to it, but again, it just feels like we're just going over the same territory we covered in the first cartoon in that particular episode. The real sort of highlight of the first episode is they do a parody of Goodnight Moon called Nighty Night Tune, and it's it basically serves to introduce all the main characters that make up the Animaniacs cast. And it takes place in the Warner Brothers Water Tower, which has also got a water slide, we're informed. The real golden element to it is the fact it's narrated by Jim Cummings in his Winnie the Pooh voice. So it's just really kind of special just to hear Winnie the Pooh doing something a little more adult. So. I'm kind of up there with like Apocalypse Pooh, if we're
okay.
If you've never seen the short Apocalypse Pooh, I really recommend you check it out. Basically, it's a Winnie the Pooh episode, but they've redubbed it with Apocalypse Now, the classic Vietnam movie. So to see Pooh flying on a kite to Can't Get No Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones, or
oh dear.
Piglet going on about seeing a fucking tiger. It's just like when he sees the ticker, it's really worth watching. So we're throwing the show notes there. But is there anything else you want to talk about Animaniacs about?
No, that's pretty much all I have to say on the subject of the Animaniacs.
We are going to take a quick break. When we return, though, we are going to be looking at Inside Number 9.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Cinema Recall Podcast here at ThatMomentIn.com. I am your host, Laverne, and on each episode, myself, along with a guest, we'll be talking about an iconic scene from a classic movie. Which films will we be discussing? Well, that's all up to you, because before each episode airs, we're going to be giving you a poll of great flicks to choose from. Whichever one gets the most votes, that's the one we'll be talking about. So, listen to the Cinema Recall Podcast on the site ThatMomentIn.com or on iTunes, Stitcher Radio, or Podomatic, or SoundCloud. Thank you very much, and hope you enjoy it.
Worth it.
And we're back. Thank you, of course, to the new joiners. In the first half, we're talking about Animaniacs. If you haven't done already, please do like or follow us on Twitter or Facebook. You can also check out our full archive on thatmomentin.com, where we are part of the podcast network there, and you can listen to that either through the site, or you can listen to it their complete archive on Spotify or Podomatic. There's a whole range of ways to listen to it, or of course, if you just want our episodes, you can also just subscribe to us on Podomatic or iTunes as well. While you're on there, maybe leave us a review, let us know some feedback. It all helps our stairs and helps get the show out there, which is always appreciated. But we are now going to be talking about Lackey's pick for the evening, which is Inside Number 9, a show which I think since I first met you, Lackey, you've been talking about this show on one way or another. I think the first TV episode that the Lamb cast ever did, which is where we sort of first met, and you were saying about Inside Number 9, and I remember thinking it was like a really sort of fascinating sort of episode. I mean, it was on that episode as well that I realized I met someone who's on the same sort of wavelength for myself when you recognized who Senor Spielberger was. So,
yep,
that's very appreciated.
Yeah, I always like to make the when I'm talking about cut rate horror directors, I also always like to say this was directed by Steven Spielberg, Senor Spielberger's contemporaries, Senor Cronenberg.
Nice. I mean, Inside Number 9, this is really offshoot in many ways of Legal Gentlemen, but I mean, what is it that you like so much about the show? I mean, you've obviously talked about it on more than one occasion, and now we're finally getting around to watching it.
It's written by and created and written by and most of the episodes star Steve Pemberton and Reese Shearsmith, who are half of the League of Gentlemen. And the League of Gentlemen, I actually got introduced to these two actors before the League of Gentlemen. Before I actually saw the League of Gentlemen, I saw their show that was the follow-up to the League of Gentlemen, which was called Psychoville, that starred them and Dawn French and a couple of other people. Daniel Kaluuya, I believe, was in it before he got really big with Black Mirror and then stuff like Get Out. But anyway, and then I watched League of Gentlemen, and this is an anthology show. It's a different show every week. It's a different kind of thing, half hour every week. It's a different kind of genre and a different kind of style. And it's very, with the thing that I like about the League of Gentlemen aesthetic, the kind of the aesthetic, you were talking about Kim Newman earlier. And I think there's a very similar kind of set of influences that again, the British horror aesthetic, which comes through not only, which also comes through in Kim Newman, but also comes through in comes through with the League of Gentlemen, particularly with the third performing member Mark Gatiss. But there's this sort of it's comedy, but it's a specific, very British type of dark comedy. It's this episode in particular is probably I'll tell you, before Total Recall, before it aired, I would have said this was probably my favorite television episode of the decade. This is almost entirely silent episode. There's one line of actual intelligible dialogue in the whole episode, and it's at the end. And the situation is that Pemberton and Shearsmith play this this pair of burglars who are breaking into this large, ridiculously postmodern house that's lived in by Dennis Lawson, who's probably best known for being Ewan McGregor's uncle, and second best known for playing Wedge in the Star Wars films. He was also in Jekyll. And then it's lived in by Dennis Lawson and Una Chaplin from Game of Thrones. And they're there to steal, Pemberton and Shearsmith are there to steal this painting. But it's this sort of almost, it's this very farcical comedy of errors the entire time. About 7 or 8, it looks like it's just going to be light, frothy comedy. And it starts to get a little bit darker about 7-8 minutes in. There's this wonderful gag where, you know, they have this, the married couple played by Lawson and Chaplin have this very yappy little dog that comes in and starts barking at Steve Pemberton, and Steve Pemberton's got to try to find a way to get rid of it. So he's taking like these little bits of meat and leading them up to the sliding door, hopefully so that this little yappy dog will follow them, eat them, and go outside. And he opens the door, and this gigantic Irish wolfhound comes in. So he's got to try to figure out how to get these two dogs out of the house. And then Shearsmith comes in, gets the big dog out of the house, while Pemberton is occupied with the small dog. Shearsmith closes the sliding door. Pemberton spins around and throws the small dog, thinking that the door is still open, but it's not. You know,
odd. And I laugh so hard at that sequence, and I feel kind of bad about it. But it's the same. It's provoked the same sort of reaction I saw when they do. When we watch Reanimator and he throws the zombie cat against the wall. It's just,
yeah, it's like May throwing the in the movie Meg. It's like her throwing the ashtray at the cat.
Yes,
or any of the dog murders in Fish Called Wanda. You know, you laugh and then you feel bad because you laughed at an animal dying.
I mean, just on that. The whole dog sequence. I mean, I thought the joke was really great. Like, he throws the dog and you don't realize the screen door's been closed and it thumps off there. Where it sort of lost a lot of its edge, that joke, is where they're hiding the dog inside an umbrella stand, and then we see Risha Smith stabbing the dog to death with an umbrella. And I thought, you know, that's just a step too far. I'm like, for some reason in my mind, it's like, it's funny to see the dog thrown against the screen door to then kill it with an umbrella. It was just like a step too far, and I thought that's one of the few weak points of this episode. That and the ending, the end, sort of like the last bit at the end, which we're obviously, I think we'll talk about in a bit, but uh-huh. Yeah, I mean, that is probably one of my favorite jokes of this particular episode. It's just that particular moment just made me laugh so bad.
But what kind of, like I said, starts off as kind of like the sort of what you think is going to be this light, frothy episode, starts to get really, start to twist until it starts to get kind of really dark when we actually start to learn about, again, and the fact that they're able to, you know, communicate what's going on between this couple is without doing any dialogue. It's just brilliant that they're this couple that's clearly having problems in their marriage. And just this kind of, there's this twist that comes about halfway through the episode where you really kind of start to get the idea of kind of, there's a lot more going on here than, you know, that we were in, you know, initially privy to. And I think a lot of that is just handled absolutely brilliantly. And then it's juxtaposed with all these other brilliant visual gags. The one that was actually my favorite was the bit where they take the painting that they're supposed to get is basically this white canvas with a strip of silver paint on one side and in one corner, like this sort of yellow square, you know, and they remove the painting from the frame. And then they realize that they've got to kind of have like a decoy in place so that the owners of the house don't realize it's gone. So they basically replace it with some paper towels and a strip of tin foil and a post-it note. And nobody ever seems to notice. You know, there's this brilliant scene where Una Chaplin is going from one place to another. She turns to look at it. There, you just focus on the focus on the former painting, and she just looks at it and kind of almost does a sort of shrugs and then walks away. But the whole thing about one of the things that is really kind of the hallmark of Inside Number 9 are these twists and this constant kind of feeling that you never really are sure of your footing in the episode. You're never really sure what's going to happen necessarily, what's going to happen next. And that's something, the reason I particularly love this episode is because it combines kind of a very experimental way of making a half hour of television with the with that. But that's kind of that's the hallmark of Inside Number 9, is kind of like that twist. It's very much kind of a Twilight Zone or Alfred Hitchcock type show. And this one, when the ultimate, a number of ultimate reveals, which, can we get into some spoilers here?
Yeah, we can. I think we've established what it's about. Spoiler alert ahead, I guess.
Spoiler, sweetie, shish. About halfway through the episode, we are basically given the information that, you know, that basically the Una Chaplin's character is a trans woman. And this episode was done in 2014, and I think it was done, that kind of scene where it was done, where you see Una Chaplin's character kind of go to the bathroom peeing standing up. I think that was probably about, it's done to an extent for laughs, and that's to me the one scene that kind of, this was, I think, kind of maybe might have been made at probably about the last point in time where you could do play a scene like that for laughs.
Yeah, I would definitely say so. Because prior to that, the only one that sort of comes out of that would be obviously Mrs. Doubtfire, which is less about him being a tranny than just obviously that the child's reveal that obviously their father's dressed up as the housekeeper.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this is the thing with this episode. It just constantly found new and unique ways to surprise and do new interesting things. I mean, I was never sure where the story was going to go next, and I think that was kind of exciting about it. And it's kind of in why, in many ways, when we get to the end, where we're introduced to this deaf and dumb cleaning salesman played by Kayvan Novak, who is probably best known as the creator of Face Jacker and Phone Jacker. He's an absolutely phenomenal impressionist. Here he's playing this different dumb cleaning supply salesman, and he'd kind of slowed the episode down, because up until this point we've got these two bumbling crooks right from the start. It's sort of like it's got that sort of real undertone of being like the silent comedy era, and certainly in the way the episode progresses, it very much in the same sort of style. So If you release two as like basically like your Laurel and Hardy, it's, and it, the whole episode works in the same way, where it's sort of like joke, and then payoff. As they just like, they've got their simple task, but they're constantly finding ways to overcomplicate it and screw it up. And just seeing them, where they're sort of like trying to sneak up on the house and they keep setting the security light off. And you see them in the right background, they're trying to sneak under the beam and trying not to set it off, and then they're attacking it with a broom. So it's right from the start, it really establishes their character. And even when we got like Steve Pemberton's character, who is basically he's the first one sneaked in, and we got Reese Shearsmith's character, who keeps texting him, and it of course keeps setting his phone off to beep, and he's like, my phone's not on silent. And we have Reese Shearsmith's character texting the instruction to put his phone on silent. These stupid text messages keeps receiving, and all the while he's trying to sneak behind this Dennis Lawson's character. As I said, you would never know. You're constantly like on edge, like, are they going to get caught? Is this next thing going to cause an issue? And they keep encountering all these different problems, and they manage to do a fair amount of damage to themselves. I mean, Rishia Smith gets maced and then shoves chilies in his face.
Pemberton.
I always get the two confused here.
Pemberton.
So Pemberton, he gets maced, and he's kind of like the more bumbling one, and then you got Shearsmith, who's kind of like the more sort of devious, the sort of brains of the operation. So it's, again, if we wanted to compare it to Animaniacs, we really have got the pinky in the brain here. I think it was just like the complete unexpected nature of well over three quarters of this that really kept my sort of interest. And when you're seeing like Shearsmith and he's hiding under the bed, and he's seeing Una Chaplin's character, Sabrina, the sort of like trophy wife character, and he discovers he's trying, but at the same time, he's dealing with a sex doll that's under the bed, and he's trying to stop it squeaking, and he's trying to find where on the doll where the squeak's coming from, and obviously there's some fun sex comedy humor there as well, but I came into this as a fan of League of Gentlemen. I've never watched Psychoville. But certainly as a League of Gentlemen fan, there's a lot to sort of enjoy in certainly that same sort of black humour here. Even if it's not particularly, in this episode, it's certainly not going as dark as League of Gentlemen did. And I think it really, the fact that Mark Gatiss isn't involved in this show, I think is the reason why it doesn't go as dark, because obviously Mark Gatiss is like the real horror aficionado. I mean, he's done his own series looking at horror films. So I think the fact that he's removed from the writing team, and it's, as I said, it's just Pemberton and Shearsmith, that the humor is sort of a little more toned down, even though it still has that black comedy element to it. It doesn't feel the need to go as dark, and I'm not sure this is this true for the rest of the series, because I mean, it could, after this episode, they could have like the darkest episode ever. I don't know, so I'm just going off my own impressions here of obviously what I saw with this episode. But yeah, I mean, this is certainly, as I said before we came on the air, I mean, this is another of those lucky picks where he gives me something to watch, and then I spend like the next month just watching that show because I become hooked on it. And just what I saw here, I just really wanted to go and see what else they do with the format, because as you said, it's different in every episode. And as Shearsmith points out, if you didn't like a particular episode, you know, you may like the next one. So like the Twilight Zone, Outer Limits, Tales from the Dark Side, it works in that sort of anthology format, which is it's great to see. And especially in these times where there's so few anthology shows, I think we got this, we've got Black Mirror, there's no real sort of anthology shows that really sort of...
Jordan Peele is producing a revival of The Twilight Zone.
Okay. And I love the fact, as I said, this is all set in one location. And I love the fact that we've got two actresses who are really trying, they're like experimenting with what they're doing. It's all like, well, let's do an episode where no one talks. for the most part. I mean, there are obviously bits of dialogue here, and just even if we remove, like, the comedic element, just what we're watching from a drama standpoint, the fact that when we see, when we're seeing this couple, how they're interacting, like, Dennis, especially Dennis Lawson's character, the fact he's, like, he produces a gun at one point, and I mean, is he going to kill himself? Is he going to kill his wife? It's all like, where's the story going to go? I mean, we've just introduced this new dangerous element. It's like, just from the drama sort of standpoint, just seeing Des Lawson's character and Ernie Chaplin's character, just their interactions as on the couch, because he's obviously very much like the sort of rich businessman who's into like classical music and fine eating, and she sort of like, as I said, she's a trophy wife, so she wants to watch EastEnders, and you see the two clashing over who gets to watch, whether they're going to have the stereo on, which is playing like the classical music, or they're going to have the TV on, which is obviously playing EastEnders.
Right.
And certainly when we look at the musical cues as well, the fact that we got elements of Eric Carmen's All By Myself and
au contraire, Bad Fingers, Without You.
Okay. Which obviously, I mean, that song is, I think since I saw Rules of Attraction, that song's been screwed up in my head well before this attempted to.
And the interesting thing about that song, about Without You, is that both of the writers of that song committed suicide. So if you know anything about Badfinger, that kind of creates an additional kind of interesting. And I don't know if Shear Smith and Pemberton chose that song for that reason. But every time I see that song comes on, it gives me, because I know what's coming. It gives me kind of an extra churn to the stomach, because not only do I know what's coming, I always think, yeah, and then Pete Ham and Tom Evans killed themselves, you know? So it's, you know, it's my mind is just a wonderful little happy place.
Yeah, it certainly is. I mean, I think Inside Number 9, it's, in many ways, it's kind of like a remnant of, it's like that next wave. As we said before, when we look at British comedy, you had like that punk sort of era, which was like The Young Ones and Bottom and Danger Brothers and those sorts of shows. And then you obviously, and like Blackadder. And then we had the era which sort of followed, which was like Spaced and Black Books and Picture. Uh-huh. And then we obviously have like this new, so this is kind of like I don't know how to sort of put it, whether it's like an era after it, and it's that this is sort of following in. This is like the new sort of era that's following in, even though the shows like this are very sort of on their own. But yeah, there's something I just really, really enjoyed about this, and I think this is one that I would put along. It's sort of one to follow, but somewhere between Black Mirror and Brass Eye.
Yeah,
it fits somewhere in between that on my shelf of where I'm going to put it. It's because obviously it's a comedy, but it's a dark one, and
right.
The
interesting thing about it is that being an anthology, it's not every episode has kind of like a different ratio of like kind of comedy to tragedy. I guess some of them are more outright comedic, some of them are more kind of like less sort of laugh out loud and more absurdist. Like the one that follows this one, Tom and Jerry, is, if I remember correctly, it's a little bit more on the absurd side, but it's less actually kind of laugh out loud funny.
Okay.
The one before this, the one with, what's her name from, I always forget her name, but she played, Jen on IT Crowd. Yeah. That one is a little bit more on the. That one's a little bit. That's a darker one as well, but it is more of the. It's kind of like this one, but less experimental, you know, in format. But it's still kind of like got the. Starts off fairly kind of frothy and funny, and then starts to kind of get this sort of churning dread in.
Okay.
Cool. But. Yeah, this is the sort of stuff that really kind of plays that kind of combination of, like, disturbing material and funny material, and this material that you find funny but is disturbing. I think that's a balance the show plays really well. It's done. I think they've got their only the first three series are available over here in the States through BritBox. This is the reason I have a BritBox.
Oh, BritBox is... I love BritBox, the fact that it's not available to British audiences. And the BBC, who obviously supply material for it, have supplied classic Doctor Who episodes that aren't available anywhere in the UK. So, great work, BBC.
The BBC wants to sell the new Blu-ray box sets. So, of Doctor Who. So now I have to rebuy all those Doctor Who home media. Thanks, BBC.
Really? I mean, it's only going to look so good. I mean, there's only... I don't know. I mean...
It's... Honestly, it's the extras.
Okay, yeah.
Doctor Who... You know, the very first TV DVD, the first time I ever bought The first time I bought DVDs that had TV episodes on them were the Doctor Who DVDs. And they have basically, most of the time, it's one story arc per DVD, per release. So it gets expensive.
Yeah.
Because there's like 120 releases. But kind of to make up for that, every DVD basically has a feature film's worth of extras. A making of featurette, a couple historic featurettes. Let's get Kim Newman or Mark Gatiss or Steve Moffat in the studio and ask him, you know, ask them what they think about this episode. Let's do a featurette on Sarah Jane Smith. Let's do a featurette on the Daleks and so forth. I remember getting Doctor Who DVDs, and everyone has a commentary track, every single one. And I remember being really, really disappointed when I bought my first full season DVD set of some other show, and it was a full season, and not every episode had a commentary track.
Okay.
You know, that was like, what? You know, so that's that kind of diversion there. So it really is not so much about the actual episodes, which you've probably seen a dozen times anyway. And in the case of Genesis of the Daleks, I've even seen that in a movie theater. It's really that they've gotten, you know, they do these featurettes, and some of the featurettes really are kind of like the last time a lot of these people ever appeared on camera, because this we're talking about things that, you know, were made 50, 60 years ago. But back to Inside Number 9. I know there's a fourth series out there. I don't think it's come to BritBox yet. But Inside Number 9 is the reason I have a BritBox subscription. Although, I guess there is a new version of My Grey, which stars Rowan Atkinson in the title role. So I got to watch that sometime, because I'd like to see Rowan Atkinson try his hand at dramatic acting.
I've not actually seen it, so.
Pardon?
I've not seen it, so I can't comment.
They're playing My Grey as a farce now. But to get back onto the subject of Inside Number 9, because I have diverted quite a bit. It's just that sort of thing that just really kind of like the combination of, you know, disturbing stuff and funny stuff and funnily disturbing stuff. That's really kind of right in my wheelhouse. That is really kind of the thing that I really want, something that's going to make me laugh and feel uncomfortable at the same time. And Inside Number 9 has a lot of really, really good episodes that really, it's one of my favorite shows right now. And I'm glad that it seems to have found some sort of audience, and that the BBC or whoever's making it, financing it, has seen fit to continue to finance it, because I think it's a great show.
Yeah, definitely. I believe it is available on Amazon Prime at the moment. So
in the United States, yeah, through on Amazon Prime, through BritBox.
Okay.
You need a BritBox subscription to get it through Amazon Prime. And I don't know about Britain, but in the States, you need it. That's what you need.
No, in the UK, you can just as long as you go on Amazon Prime, you're fine. So,
you're Brits. You don't need a BritBox subscription.
Apparently, we do to see half of the stuff that's on there. So, another great move by the BBC.
Okay.
Cool. Anything else you want to discuss in this one?
No, that's about it.
So that brings us to the end of another exciting edition of TV Good Sleep Bad. We hope you've enjoyed listening. Of course, if you haven't done already, please do hit the like and subscribe buttons where you're listening to us on Podomatic or iTunes, or if you're listening to us at thatmountain.com, where again you can find our complete archive of episodes. Yeah, you can find our complete archive of episodes, as well as following all the ThatMountain.com podcast network shows through Spotify as well. Coming up on the network, there are many exciting things afoot. Over on the Asian Cinema Film Club, they're looking at Satoshi Kon's Perfect Blue. On Game Warp, they are currently looking at We Happy Few, as well as Don't Nod Entertainment's debut game, Remember Me, ahead of the release of Life is Strange 2. Over with the Van on Cinema Recall, he is looking at Cult Cinema, as well as taking a look back at Charlie's Angels as well. Cinema Recall also do have some exciting things happening on their Patreon as well, so if you haven't checked it out, definitely check that out. There are some great bonus episodes as well if you want to throw a couple of bucks Van's way. Other than that, on the site, thatmountain.com, there are obviously plenty of reviews, other fun articles on there. The Movie Tourist is a new piece up for there as well, looking at The Hostel from Hostel. Definitely check it out, thatmountain.com, for all some more great podcasts and some great writing as well. Let's say thank you as always to my co-host, Mr. Aaron Lackey.
Thank you very much.
And before we obviously go, I mean, what do you want to look at on our next episode?
I said that we really should do the Powerpuff Girls sometime. So guess what? We're going to do the Powerpuff Girls next episode. We're going to do the 12th episode of the third season, which is features two stories, Moral Decay and Meet the Beat Alls.
Cool. For myself, I'm going to look at some more classic 90s TV. We're going to be looking at an episode of Thunder in Paradise, the Hulk Hogan action Saturday afternoon TV vehicle, where he plays Randolph J. Hurricane Spencer and teams up with character actor extraordinaire Chris Lemon, who plays here Martin Brew Boo Barker, as a pair of mercenaries who hang out in the tropics and defeating criminal types from the makers of Baywatch. The episode we're going to be watching, though, is Queen of Hearts, which is episode 13. This is an episode which not only features a robot dinosaur, but the wrestler Terry Funk. It's got monster trucks and a very special guest star, as well as getting to see Patrick McNee. So if you're... That's going to be exciting for someone, I hope.
That's I don't think a more 90s set of words has ever been assembled into one group of sentences.
Oh, Thunder in Paradise is something rather special, even if it does feature noted racist Hulk Hogan. It's certainly something special, and I'm trying not to reveal too much about this episode just because it is probably one of the most bonkers Arrow TV that has ever been committed to film. So that's all to look forward on next episode. We look at Thunder in Paradise as well as Powerpuff Girls. But thank you again for listening, and this is Edward Jones reminding you as always to keep it strange.